Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the obstacles and opportunities open to small to mid-sized enterprises that manufacture here in America. Brought to you by All Metals and Forge Group, with your hosts, Tim Grady and Lou Wise.
Welcome, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio. We're glad you're here with us this week. We have got a very interesting program on apprenticeship programs. You've heard us talk about this subject before, but today we're going to give you some actual meat on the bones, some actual solutions that you can implement. Some of these are coming out of the great state of Connecticut. They've got some really sharp things happening up there. We'll be talking to our two guests about that in a moment. Right now, I want to check in with Lou Wise, my co-host. Lou is the president of All Metals and Forge Group, the sponsor for Manufacturing Talk Radio. Lou, what's going on up in New Jersey?
Well, I'm up because you're in Atlanta, so everything is just fine here. I do have the postscript for last week's show for our listeners to contemplate going back and listening to it. It's an hour show that we had regarding the ultimate economic indicator for U.S. manufacturers. And I'll bet if I ask that question to five people, no one will get that answer right. That being said, we were talking about the state of the machine tool industry. And machine tool manufacturing and tool making has always been a precursor for the economy that comes 6 to 9 months down the road. It was an interesting show. They did talk about ups and downs, bumps and lumps. I strongly suggest that you want to hear a little bit more about this indicator that you go to last week's show at mfgtalkradio.com and listen to the folks that we had on last week. We have a couple of news items, and one of them is really kind of exciting because I actually was there and saw it under construction on multiple occasions. This past weekend, the new, improved, larger, deeper Panama Canal opened 2 years late. Maybe Donald should have built it and had the Mexicans pay for that one also. I think they may have had a problem with that, though. Project cost $5.2 billion. 2 years late, they wanted to open it on the 100th anniversary of the first canal that the U.S. built in 1914, but clearly they missed it by 2 years. And then, of course, we then made the second big mistake on that, is that, and this was not part of any of the news articles that I saw or any of the wire clips that I saw, but in 2003, we gave it away. We didn't sell it. It's all of our infrastructure, our power grid, our water system, our technology, and we gave it away. Now, I don't know if anybody has any idea how much it costs, but it costs about $5 million in fuel to go around South America. And the last number I heard was that it cost something like $100,000 or $150,000 to go through the canal. And they actually go out to the ships that are waiting in line to go through the canal. They bring the purser along in the terminal building. They take his credit card. They run the credit card. No cash flow problems whatsoever. And we gave it away. That is stunning. And actually, that should probably have been the first of a new series that Tim and I are going to be doing. And we're going to be doing it in this show. At the end of the show, we're going to be calling it Federal Follies, and I'm sure we made many more than just the Panama Canal, but that should be one of the federal follies. And we will be doing that every week at the end of the show. We're going to whip them, kick them, belittle and berate them. We're going to pick on everybody who does something stupid and asinine. We do happen to have one, though, for this show, in spite of the Panama Canal. So we're going to wait until the end so you can all hear it at that time. The next news, which is hard to do news this week unless you bring up Brexit and what the Brits did to themselves. And Tim, why don't you throw some of your opinions in on this one? You and I have had some private conversations over the last couple of days about how stupid they're doing things.
Well, I don't know what their political reasons for doing it was. What they did was take a gamble when they decided to exit the European Union. And, of course, now they have to renegotiate all of their agreements with all of the other EU partners. The challenge now is that Scotland wants to be part of the EU, so Scotland now wants to withdraw from the United Kingdom. And Ireland is following suit. So the UK may boil down to Britain and Wales.
Queen Betty called me this morning, and she said she's not happy with all of this. You know, she's concerned that the $50 million that the government supplies them to live in a lifestyle of the kings and queens might be in question also. So it was amazing that the story that came out the day after the vote in the London Mail, or the Daily Mail, was that for the most part, the people didn't really know what was involved. And it was shocking the next morning when the newspapers started getting phone calls from people saying, what is this? What are you talking about? And the people really didn't know what it was about. So I guess we all have our follies, don't we? Tim, I'm going to flip this back to you.
Well, let's talk about apprenticeship programs. We have addressed this subject before, but we have two guests on the show today from the state of Connecticut. And I have to introduce them separately to just have a moment with each of them, because there's some really remarkable things happening in the state of Connecticut. Todd Birch is manager of the Office of Apprenticeship Training with the Connecticut Department of Labor. And they've been running apprenticeship programs for quite a while. Todd, how are you doing today?
Hi, how are you doing today? I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me on.
Good. So we appreciate you having you on. And we also have Gary Coviello, who's Technical Support and Safety Manager at the Carvey Corporation. I was talking with Gary briefly before the show, and I thought I heard him say that he's been working with the state of Connecticut on apprenticeship programs for 3 years, and I would have been impressed. He said 30 years, which blew my doors off. Gary, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Tim. And, it's 30 years, and we're happy to do it.
So, Todd, give me an idea of how you work with companies like the Carvey Corporation and help them develop apprenticeship programs.
Sure. Well, we're proud to say in the state of Connecticut that apprenticeship is a Connecticut tradition. Next month, we'll be celebrating 79 years that the National Apprenticeship Law, also known as the Fitzgerald Act, was federally passed. William Fitzgerald was a resident of Norwich, Connecticut. He was a congressman. Later became Commissioner of Labor, was always an ardent advocate of apprenticeship while he was promoting the furtherance of standards necessary to safeguard the welfare and opportunities of apprentices. And we're proud that he came from Connecticut. This was passed on a national level, and the birthplace of apprenticeship ran through Connecticut in its beginnings. It's been a fantastic program over and over again throughout the world.
And you have how many companies that you're working with up in Connecticut on apprenticeship programs?
Right now I have over 1,600 companies, and I've just broken my self-imposed threshold of 6,000 registered apprentices amongst those companies.
Wow. That's impressive.
Gary, how did you get involved with an apprenticeship program in the state of Connecticut 30 years ago, long before we heard about the skills gap and can't find people to fill jobs? You were way ahead of the curve.
Well, you know, I think as we said before, apprenticeship programs in the state of Connecticut are not new. My father actually served an apprenticeship. He was an Islet toolmaker back in the early 50s. I went through school, and after school, I decided that I'd rather make parts than design them, and I had an opportunity to serve an apprenticeship, and I did. That was back in 1970. So having come from that and seeing that, skilled labor is a finite thing, and the only way we're going to get people is to train them. So we made a decision way back to start training our people, and this company has grown, and we've pulled a lot of people out of that program, and we've been very fortunate to retain most of them. Some have left, but we retained a lot.
Is Connecticut one of the first states to get involved in this? Because 37 years ago is a long time ago.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if Connecticut was one of the first or not.
Todd, what was the history you gave us on apprenticeship programs in Connecticut?
I don't have the data when we actually started in Connecticut. There was a lot of different implementations. It started on a national level in 1937. So probably Connecticut very shortly after there. I just don't have that number handy, unfortunately.
Okay.
But the bill was introduced by a congressman from Connecticut who was specific to the needs of young workers in the textile mills in eastern Connecticut. As history serves us, the atrocities of child labor back then. And this gentleman stood up for basically protecting children at that time from conditions that he thought were a little bit bizarre.
Was this part of the New Deal era during the Roosevelt years?
Right just before it. So this was in 1937. So it's a couple years before that.
Ah. Okay.
So, Gary, step number one, which I think people are coming to grips with, we all thought, gee, maybe they'll come out of school trained for us. We're discovering that's not true.
No.
Number one, you've got to train them yourself. Would you agree, Gary?
Yeah, we do bring in pre-apprentices that come out of the local vocational school. As juniors, they can work under what they have what's called a work-based learning program. When they're in their shop cycle, they can come in and work in the shop. And we've started quite a few people off as pre-apprentices. And the beauty of that is those hours count towards their regular apprenticeship. So when they graduate, they can go on a full-time apprenticeship and probably be done with their apprenticeship by the time they're 22 years old.
Several weeks ago, we were at the German consulate in New York, and I had a panel discussion with several German educators and manufacturers and government officials, as well as New Jersey Institute of Technology here in New Jersey. And they were talking about the dual educational system, which required in Germany two days of vocational training and 3 days of liberal arts, reading, writing, arithmetic, and so on. Is this a similar type program?
I don't know exactly how it's broken down within mm-hmm. the school, but yeah, it is. They have a certain amount of academics and then a certain amount of shop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the state of Connecticut has the Connecticut Technical High School system. It's the only one in the country that's statewide. There are currently 16 technical high schools in the state of Connecticut that work as one. As far as curriculum, they have various vocations: auto body, carpentry, machine tool manufacturing, plumbing. They all have a set curriculum, and the high school setup is, if I remember correctly, there are 2 weeks in academics and then 2 weeks in their vocational studies, which is their shop, so to speak, where they're learning from the vocational type of curriculum. or as Gary had mentioned, some of them in their junior year get released to go actually work for an employer as a, what they call a pre-apprentice, which is a pipeline for them to leave high school with apprenticeable theory as well as hands-on, and they're well on their way to becoming a journeyperson in some sort of industry of manufacturing.
Well, this is fantastic because part of that discussion that we had with Germany and some of the U.S. folks about the apprenticeship programs, it was kind of dismal as to what the facts are coming out of the United States, that a lot of school systems are first beginning to put shop back on the curriculum. There are some areas that can't afford it, so they don't do shop. And one of the big problems that Tim and I see over the last 3 years is that, you know, the parents have not been trained either to have their kids go to they want them to go to college. Everybody wants their kid to have a college degree, a $200,000 debt, come back, live in the house, and not have a job. So I think your way probably works better. And it's by the numbers, would you say 6,000 are signed up?
That's correct. And I have to agree with you in regard to tuition. We refer to, and I think Gary would agree with this, that I also was an apprentice. I'm a steam fitter pipe welder by trade, and now I'm very, very fortunate that I run this program. It is definitely a grow-your-own-career. When you have the prospect, and again, nothing against higher education, while working and earning a wage, the apprentice receives a valuable education. If they go for their related instruction in the state of Connecticut to a community college, they're also getting an associate's degree. So they're learning a vocation, they're getting an associate's degree, all the while they're making money, so and not incurring any debt, where others are going straight to college and they've received a hefty debt and no promise of a job at all. So I totally agree with you. And with regard to that German consulate, I believe there was a company there called Trumpf, if I was correct.
Yes. They were there also.
They are one of our registered apprenticeship sponsors in the state of Connecticut. We're very proud of their work.
Excellent. Yeah, they were at the event also, as well. It's interesting that I'm in the metals industry 50 years, and I remember my father was of European extraction. He moved to the United States in the early 1900s. And when I became mid-teens, he said, you know, you ought to go to my union because it's a father-son union. And they'll train you, and you'll always have a profession. And I said, Pop, I wasn't interested. And he would have been right in one extent, but he would have been ultimately wrong because they don't have line-of-type operators anymore. And that's what my father was his whole life. And they didn't take it away. They just shut down the whole technology. So I'm glad I wound up doing what I'm doing.
Todd, the state of Connecticut has got several initiatives and new programs going on. Would you share those with our listeners?
Sure. Well, I mean, it also comes from the federal level and just the state and the federal level. Manufacturers in the state of Connecticut, to their credit, have for years gone to their government and said, we need help. We need skilled workers, and we need them now. So the deliberations of state government take some time, but we can agree that this is an immediate need. And it goes back to, you know, the fostering of people need to go to college all the time. There was, you know, more addressing the skills gap, there's been a very large gap in those that especially the parents, that want to keep their kids away from the 3Ds, the dirty, dark, dangerous machine shops. The ones that I've been into are cleaner than a surgery surgery suite at a hospital. They're fantastic. The state has actually had an initiative. Before I get into financial initiatives, we just had our legislative session this year. It just wound down about a month ago. And we had a public act signed. It was an act encouraging middle school and high school students to consider careers in manufacturing. There's going to be a commission, a board convened, various representatives to get together and to start the conversation. How do we get not only students but parents involved in an early age, 6th and 7th grade, to have an understanding that manufacturing, though some have thought it had gone away for a bit of time, mind you, that we still make a tremendous amount of the durable goods that are created for the entire world, but it's a viable pathway for a very, very good paying job with no debt for higher education. So it's been a conversation that's been going for quite some time. There are manufacturing associations. There are 5 in the state of Connecticut that do very, very good work. The apprenticeship program itself and those that actually agree to becoming registered sponsors, like the Carby Corporation, I mean, that's just it's a tradition. It's been around for a long time. It's a proven fact that it works. And when you had said, you know, that they have been around for 30 years, that doesn't surprise me. I have one in particular plumbing company that has been around for 107 years, and they've had registered apprentices or something like that, you know, or apprentices, I should say, since that time. We also have in the state of Connecticut on a financial basis, again, industry saying, you know, please help us. We have something called the Manufacturing Innovation Fund, which supports manufacturing in efforts to train registered apprentice workers in their appropriate skills. And there are wage subsidies with a cap of $6,000 for year one and $7,000 for year two. There's also related instruction reimbursement to the company for $2,500 for year one and $1,250 for year two. And there's a lot of credentialing in manufacturing, allowing for $1,000 worth of credentialing costs in those years. A fantastic program. It's working very well. There's also some manufacturing tax credits, a manufacturing tax credit right now that's available for the development of skilled workers. And it goes against the corporate business tax, up to $7,500 per apprentice. So by industry asking its government in the state of Connecticut, give us some help. They've definitely come through with a good portion of available resources for them. There's also, this is from the White House, national level, the American Apprenticeship Initiative grant, which we received. Again, it's to expand apprenticeships in what we call non-traditional occupation. And manufacturing falls into that category. We call it non-traditional due to the fact that there's different aspects of, you know, medical devices, so on and so forth, that manufacturers are creating. And that gets, it's basically like a partial scholarship for education. The community college system in the state of Connecticut is starting to become a pipeline for training people to get into manufacturing. It's a 10-month certification program. That coalesced with a registered apprenticeship program is no doubt, and I hope Gary would agree with me, is the way to go. You get some education, some hands-on on the shop floor, in the manufacturing centers, in the community colleges, and then you become a registered apprentice, and that's the way to go. So that's what we have. That's some of the initiatives we have in the state of Connecticut. We're pretty proud of them. We would like everybody to say, hey, this is absolutely fantastic, best thing since sliced bread. Unfortunately, a lot of people are sometimes a little bit leery of government, and that's just the way it goes. We are the Department of Labor. We're here to help businesses. We're here to help employees as well. And I spend every single day trying to talk to people about how positive these programs are, and just all they need to do is just sign up. There's no not very much onerous paperwork. And it's another thing that people are fearful of when government starts handing out money to help them. A couple of pages, two, three pages. I mean, if there's an obstacle and they say, well, this is too much, well, I can look at the paperwork and hopefully say, well, either my staff can help you fill that out or, you know, what's the real big issue here? Maybe I could get rid of some of this red tape for you, because I really, really want to spur manufacturing growth in Connecticut. I mean, Connecticut's interesting. It's a very small state. It's in between two of the bigs, Boston and New York. But we make three things really, really interesting in the state of Connecticut. We make things go underwater with our submarines, which is the most complicated piece of machinery in the world. We have Pratt & Whitney, which Pratt & Whitney jets are on a ton of airplanes. And we also have Sikorsky helicopter here. And we have Otis Elevator here as well. So we have some really interesting things in Connecticut. We invented the wiffle ball. We invented the first Frisbee. And a lot of it comes down to manufacturing. Again, a very small, small state. Used to be jam-packed with a lot of manufacturers. And some things have gone away because of economic conditions. But things are starting to come back because we're, no doubt about it, one of the best innovators in the entire country, if not the world, for making durable goods.
You know, it was interesting, the numbers that I heard of unemployment for the 16 to 24-year-olds in the United States is about 28%, and the same age bracket in Germany is 7%.
Right.
For all the reasons that you've just mentioned.
Right.
Gary, I want to go to you just for a moment here.
Sure.
We've identified the first thing, the first solution really is to train your apprentices yourself. But then there's this connection that it appears that you have had with working with technical, vocational, county, or community colleges. How many of your people do you draw from those kind of resources?
We draw most of them. We do have some people that have been apprentices and are apprentices now that started off in our company as machine operators and showed some potential and wanted to learn the trade, and we moved them up. But a good percentage of our people come through the schools. I'm actually a member of the Technical Trades Advisory Committee for the local vocational school, and I've also been in the Advanced Machining Center that Todd spoke about, which is very impressive. So, you know, the resources are there. I think one of the biggest problems is something that you mentioned a little bit earlier, in that there's a stigma with a lot of the parents that they have to steer their kids towards college. And, you know, I've heard comments made that, well, without college, you just can't get a job. And it's naturally, it's just not true. When we sign a pre-apprentice, naturally we have to have a parent here because they're minors, and I take them through on a tour of the plant, and they just can't believe that the plant's climate controlled, the floors are washed. It's a state-of-the-art facility. It's not what they're picturing at all. So I think we have to do a little bit better to try and get the word out as far as that goes.
This is coming up in October, the fourth year, I believe it is, for Manufacturing Day. I presume that you're well-versed in that. Do you know how many companies in Connecticut are part of that one-day event?
I don't. Todd may. I don't know offhand.
I've talked to a couple of manufacturing associations, and they're still in the beginning stages of, even though it's July now, but they're in the beginning stages of having discussion about what they would like to do for that day.
Well, just for our audience, let me just give a quick synopsis. That Manufacturing Day was started 4 years ago, and it's the first Friday in October, where the governments, various state agencies, federal agencies, manufacturing companies, and matter of fact, Trump is also part of that as well. And they open up manufacturing plants in every state in the country. I think last year there was a total of 2,400 that opened up one day that allowed students, parents, naturally teachers and consultants, anybody who wanted to see that a manufacturing plant today is no longer dark, dirty, and dangerous, and that, as you pointed out, they're clean and they are good surroundings and good environment to be working in, and they make good money. Matter of fact, when I retire, I think I'm going to become an underwater welder. They make $150,000 a year.
I've done that. I don't recommend you doing that at all, actually.
No, huh? All right, well, then I'll have to tell my wife that that's draw a line on that one through the our my list of things to do.
Yeah, you have to pick it up.
That's an interesting apprenticeship in its own right. You're, you know, if someone's coming out of a high school, just a regular high school, not a vocational school, and they get hired by a underwater welding company, how do you explain to this potential apprentice, kid, you're going to get in a diving suit and I'm going to put an electrical cord in your hand and you're going to weld? I wonder how many people they actually really have to sign up for that from time to time. But it does pay a lot, because who wants to jump in the water with an electrical cord in their hands? So.
Well, I have to tell you, by coincidence, I was on vacation a couple of weeks ago up on Cape Cod, and I happened to meet a underwater welder who takes the summer off and tends bar in one of the towns on the Cape. And he was only about 25 years old, so he makes a lot of money all year, and in the summer he parties. But he does make a lot of money, though.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun thing to do. We're going to take a short commercial break, after which we will be back with our two guests as we talk about apprenticeship programs and see if we can define a few more things for other companies that they can do. And I'm going to also talk about MFG Day just a touch when we get back from this short commercial break.
Manufacturing Talk Radio will be right back.
How do you keep your business humming? Where do you go when you're looking for quality suppliers of new equipment, components, MRO supplies, repair services, or even raw materials? 30 years ago, you would have turned to the Thomas Register. Today, those big green books are better than ever at thomasnet.com, industry's leading platform for product sourcing and supplier discovery. You can easily find that local machine shop, national distributor, OEM, or any supplier having the right quality certification, fast and free. You can even get to specific products, components, or downloadable 3D CAD drawings simply by entering specifications or part numbers. There's a reason ThomasNet.com has become the go-to supplier discovery tool for procurement professionals and engineers. There's simply no other resource like it, and it's all free. Go to ThomasNet.com today and see how top-notch supplier discovery doesn't have to put a dent into your bottom line.
American Crane and Equipment Corporation in Douglasville, Pennsylvania is a leader in specialized cranes, hoists, and material handling equipment for industries including aerospace, nuclear, oil and gas, transit, construction, and waste handling. Call 877-877-6778 or visit americancrane.com. That's americancrane.com or 877-877-6778.
All Metals and Forge Group is an ISO 9001 AS and EN 9100 manufacturer of open die forgings and seamless rolled rings in alloy, carbon, stainless and tool steels, aluminum, copper, titanium, and nickel alloys. Visit us at steelforge.com or call 800-600-9290.
Welcome back to Manufacturing Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio. I'm Tim Grady. We're talking with Gary Coviello, who is the Technical Support Safety Manager at the Carby Corporation, and Todd Birch, who's Program Manager, Connecticut Department of Labor in the Office of Apprenticeship Training. We've learned some fascinating things about what these two gentlemen are doing up in the state of Connecticut. Lou just mentioned Manufacturing Day, which can be found at mfgday.com. They put on, I think it was over 2,000 events last year, all across the country. Connecticut currently has 6 events scheduled. I happen to be down in the Atlanta area. The great state of Georgia has 1 event scheduled. Come on, Georgia, get on the stick here. We've got to get caught up. Got to open your doors and have kids come in from high schools, technical schools, vocational county and community college, or Georgia Tech, great university down here. See what you folks do in manufacturing. As Gary was pointing out, it is not dark, dirty, and dangerous anymore. I've been on some of the manufacturing floors. They're as clean as hospital floors, folks. They are as high-tech as hospitals are these days. Gary, what kind of training do you need to give these folks? Because actually what we're seeing, Lou and I were at FabTech, which was a technical trade show. We see a 1.2 million square feet of machines and people running around with iPads running them, not with grease up to their elbows. What's going on in your shop?
Well, we have that, too. We have CNC equipment where, you know, we have the capability to take a print that was designed on a CAD system, and they can import that into another computer program called a CAM system and generate a program to run the CNC machines. The people, again, are very proficient. But a lot of what we do is not only the high tech, but the old, if you want to call it old school, in the metal forming trades, it's a lot of hands on. You're getting metal to move within the dies, and it takes know how, and it takes a little bit of art and a little bit of work and a lot of experience to sit down and develop a set of tools to get it to make the part that you want.
Is there a little finesse involved in some of that, Gary?
A lot. Yeah, that's probably 95% of it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. There are a lot of things we think we can automate, but when it comes to the human eye and the human hand, it's pretty hard to get that precise. Gary, what's the youngest you see an apprentice coming into your program?
As I said, we'll take 16-year-olds in as pre-apprentices.
Okay, And Todd, you're trying to reach down into those earlier grades, grades 11 and 12. What's the challenge there to get these kids involved?
Parents.
You stole my line.
When I address a lot kids are kids. You know, they have wide eyes and big aspirations. And somebody's going to be paying the tab for their education going forward. When I show it as a business plan that they have the potential to make in 2 years as an apprentice, possibly $50,000-$60,000, or if they want to go into debt for 2 years at a college for about $90,000, it gives parents caution for pause. They think about it. And even though we're talking about manufacturing itself, there are so many different aspects of manufacturing that I think people need to be sort of awakened to. There's quality assurance. There's quality control. Depending on the size of the manufacturer, there's environmental implications where they might need an environmental engineer. There's everywhere from the person that takes care of the commissary, so to speak, all the way down to the payroll clerks. Manufacturing is a huge industry, and I think, and I agree with Gary, that's what we're trying to do as an agency and Department of Labor, is to say, hey, apprenticeship is a cool thing. These jobs are here. They're ready to go. We need folks. And what really actually personally scares me, being in this industry for a bit of time, is to see that we have what they call, and I don't like this because I'm starting to go gray myself, the graying of the industry, where people are starting to retire on the back end. And unfortunately, I think we only see anywhere from a 5 to 12-year span of time right now from today where the people that have gained those, as you guys have just referred to, the finesse factor, or the people that really know how to get things made, they can't transfer those skills into somebody coming right out of high school or right after a community college because they're all going to be retiring very soon. And there's going to be, in my opinion, if people don't engage in registered apprenticeship, the industry, unfortunately, is going to miss this little bit of an opportunity that the window's open for right now.
Well, it's interesting because the finesse factor is something that they're going to have a hard time, even with intelligent machines, to capture. You know, there's an old joke in the plumbing industry. A guy's got pipes in his basement leaking all over. He calls in a plumber. The plumber walks around the basement staring at all the pipes, pulls out a pipe wrench, puts it on one particular pipe, and gives it about half a crank, and all of the leaks across the basement stop. He hands the guy a bill for $650. And the homeowner says, $650 to take a wrench and just eat on one pipe? He said, no, $50 to go eat on one pipe. $600 to know where to go eat on which pipe.
Yeah.
That's the finesse factor that they're going to have a tough time with computers. Gary, what are the benefits for apprentices that you see from your perspective coming into the Carby Corporation?
Well, there are benefits both ways. If I could just back up just a step when you mentioned the grain factor.
Sure.
One of the big advantages that we have over, I think, a lot of companies that haven't been as aggressive in training as we have is I think our average age in the skilled section is lower than many companies, you know, because we have so many young people right now.
Right.
As far as the benefits, you know, the benefits are almost what you want to make them. You know, we train in several different areas. We train in tool making, tool and die making, eyelet tool making, machine repair. And each of those, as far as the benefits go, they're high paying jobs, they're secure jobs, along with the fringe benefits and retirement benefits to go with them. You have the security. And as Todd said several times, you don't have the debt that goes with that.
Yeah, and, right.
And you're going to have a job. You know, one of the things I always remember with my father as an Iowa toolmaker is he was never without work. So I think that's one of the biggest benefits. But
clearly.
Well, I'm glad I didn't become a linotype operator.
Yeah.
I'm glad you only looked to do the welding.
Yeah,
Todd, right. You mentioned that you can go either north or south. You can go north $60,000 a year, or you can go south $60,000 in debt. What are the benefits for apprentices that you see working with the state of Connecticut?
It's interesting. I'm going to just go to the construction trades for a minute, specifically an electrician. I was recently one of my staff representatives out signing up a brand new apprentice, and it was this employer's first apprentice that they've ever hired. This gentleman had been in business 3 years and wanted to expand, and just seeing that the guy that owns the electrical company had gone through the vocational technical high schools, went out, got his license, started his own business, and now is growing and hiring his first apprentice, that's an advantage because it gives hope not only to apprentices themselves saying, hey, I'm going to have a job and I'm going to go through a four-year program and I'm going to be very, very good at what I do. It's good to see on the employer side that they believe in what they do so much that they actually want to give somebody else a chance. So it's just seeing that apprenticeship itself is the true measure of workforce development. There's no question about it. It gives people hope as far as what they can do with their hands to feed themselves. You get a college degree, again, no disrespect to higher education. As soon as you graduate, what are you going to do? This
right.
is a totally different type of product with manufacturing, electricians, plumbers, what have you. You have a career path right in front of you that you just need to go and follow, and you're going to be great at it.
And you're doing it while you're earning while you're learning.
No sure. question about it.
If I'm not mistaken, the vacant jobs in manufacturing right now nationwide is at 3.5 million. And, you know, if the politicians succeed at something and wind up, quote-unquote, bringing jobs back to this country, who are they going to get to fill the jobs? We can't fill the jobs
right.
that we have now. So
right.
this is a terrible dilemma.
And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the graying of the industry. You're seeing in certain sectors of manufacturing, we've all seen the data, they're calling for in the next couple of years a pretty flat growth for prospective employment. But if you look at attrition or the amount of people that are retiring out of these roles, you have to backfill that. So you're not necessarily having an actual growth in manufacturing prospective job opportunities. You're having a huge opening due to the fact that people are leaving because they're retiring. So I have to agree with you.
Sure.
It's like, okay, where are we going to get these folks?
Very hard.
And there's another factor. Our population growth has slowed.
Yep.
And number two is that our population divide between male and female is 51% female now. I think it just happened within the last month or so. So now there's another pool of employees, and I'm going to ask you the question if you happen to know. Of the 6,000 apprentices that have signed up, do you know what percentage are women?
Don't have the numbers in front of me right now. We are huge advocates of women in trades, no question about it. We give opportunities. We had the Hartford Business Journal. Gary, I think you've seen this. There's another one of our sponsors found a young woman at a car wash, mm-hmm. and she was running circles around the people at the other gentlemen at the car wash that were working there. So he got into a conversation with her, and he never forgot her name and saw her very, very short time later at a community college. She wanted to become a nurse, but then decided to get into manufacturing. She just received in April, I believe it was, a national recognition for a future leader in women in manufacturing. And she she's working for a particular manufacturing company right now. And decided to go back to school to become an engineer because she knows how to make the part. Now she wants to just be able to design it and put her engineering stamp on it. So she's one of our success stories. And one of the issues that we have with women getting into non-traditional trades are two things. Transportation and daycare are very tough. If we could answer a little bit of that, just a little bit of that question, I think you could have more women expanded into the roles because –
sure.
They're ready and willing to work. There's no question about it. It's just how do we get them there and how can we help them out just a little bit? And I think we'll find a better pool of workers, no question about it.
I went to an event in Wisconsin where they had the annual conference, Women in Manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And it was really fabulous. I mean, these were young, maybe not so young, bright, educated women who realized that the way for them to make it in a different direction is going through manufacturing and ultimately get into administration. And in some cases, I met several women that have risen to the level where they own manufacturing companies. So it's really great. The only thing I objected to the whole day, of course, was having lunch with them all. They really did talk loud.
Gary, before we wrap up this segment,
I'm looking to give my apology to all the females listening.
Gary, before we wrap up this segment, Gary Coviello is technical support safety manager at the Carby Corporation. Gary, the Carby Corporation, how do people get a hold of the Carby Corporation and what's your website?
Our website is www.carbycorp.com.
Great. Gary, thank you for being on the show with us. We appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
And Todd, before we go into our next segment, which is the Federal Follies, I'd like you, and the state of Connecticut is not included in this, but I would just like you to share with our listeners how they get a hold of either you or the Office of Apprenticeship Training.
Sure. We have our own domain name, which makes it easy. That's www.ctapprenticeship.com.
Great, great. Todd Birch, who is Program Manager, Connecticut Department of Labor, Office of Apprenticeship Training. Todd, thank you for being on the show with us today.
No problem.
And those gentlemen are welcome to stay with us. We are going to jump into a new segment for Lou and I. Lou and I have talked for years on what's going on in business and government, and you've heard some comments on the show as we've gone through that. And we've decided to introduce a new segment to the show, and one of Lou's first questions are, do you think we're going to have enough fodder for the federal follies? And I said, we're never going to run out, sadly. Lou and I have talked about the XM Bank, and you've heard about the XM Bank on our show for quite some time, and there was a discussion about this organization that's been around for 80-some-odd years that helps companies put together export deals and in some cases helps them finance those deals or helps the buyer in the country where the product is going buy the product so the transaction can take place. Over the last 10 years, they've generated $7 billion net positive money into the federal treasury. I only think that the Commerce Department has a claim to fame to that for a few dollars, but the XM Bank clearly contributes to the federal government. And there was a big brouhaha at the end of last year whether or not they were going to reauthorize this 80-year-old institution. And finally, in December, a bipartisan group came together and they decided that they would reauthorize on a long-term basis the XM Bank with one proviso. That in order to have transactions above $10 million, they had to have a board of directors approve it, and each of those board members had to be appointed and nominated into the position. So they got it reauthorized. And now we're waiting for the appointments with, again, one problem. We have Senate Banking Committee Chairman, the Republican Senator out of Alabama, Richard Shelby, who personally doesn't believe in the XM Bank. So he is not personally putting any nominations forward to fill the board so that we can have the XM Bank operate at full power. So here's what we have. We have one man who is overriding a bipartisan majority of the government that reauthorized the bank because he philosophically disagrees with the existence of the XM Bank. So one guy is holding up a portion of export trade in America. Lou and I see this stuff all the time. He's in manufacturing. It makes us nuts. Thus, the federal folly. Lou?
I'm stuttering here because I'm surprised you didn't do a Timmy. And a Timmy is a total outrage where you're totally losing it, and I guess I'm the one who's going to have to do it. This guy, Richard Shelby, Republican of Alabama, it must be an idiot. Has to be an idiot. He is the one person who would fill the quorum that would allow manufacturers to borrow, and I'm giving you some more details that Tim didn't. Right now, the XM Bank can participate in transactions of under $10 million. If you have a quorum of three or more, you then can get involved in transactions larger than $10 million. And this guy, Richard Shelby, and by the way, he's coming up for election next November, November coming up. He's dead set against it because he doesn't believe in corporate welfare. He thinks this is corporate welfare. So instead of corporate welfare, you have General Electric, for example, packed up and moved to France. They packed up and moved to Canada because they can get funding over there, and they don't need XM Bank support. The problem is that we are losing more jobs. XM Bank is one of two agencies in our government that makes money. So maybe Richard Shelby is against the government making money. Maybe he's against actually creating jobs. It is despicable. I can't believe that this man was, he won in the primary. He's going to be running in November. And if you want to do something, get him out of office. And by the way, I did reach out to Richie and see if he wanted to respond to any of these comments, and I did not get any feedback, nor did I get anyone to acknowledge the situation as Tim and I have just laid it out. So my last comment, Tim, we are never going to run out of federal follies because we could have done three or four today.
Oh.
That's it. I'm done.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, this is just ridiculous. You know, there was a talk before they tried to renew this thing, and it was called, they were concerned that it was called crony capitalism. Well, let's be honest, folks. The Congress is crony capitalism. Who do you think funds the reelection of these guys? We all like to think it's us, the little guys, writing our little checks. Wrong. You know, corporate America writes big checks. They have big fundraisers and dinners at $2,000 a plate, and the corporate titans go in and contribute to these campaigns. Tell me about crony capitalism. You're holding up an Ex-Im Bank that, in the grand scheme of things, by the way, does $2 to $3 billion in transactions a year against a $1.7 trillion GDP. I hardly understand why he's holding up this small facet of the government that actually makes money. But I will tell you this. His oath of office says that he will uphold the Constitution of the United States. And the last time I checked, the Constitution starts out with three words. We, the people. Well, I hardly think he's holding up we, the people, because it was a bipartisan group of senators who authorized the bank again. And by the way, just for fun, and because we really care, Lou and I separately carry a copy of the Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence with us. So, you know, we're into it. We believe in what the document says, but I'm struggling with this one with Richard Shelby.
Get him out of office. Get him out of office. All you folks in Alabama, you are losing jobs because of this single individual. This is absolutely terrible. I can't say enough bad things about this individual with his arrogance and asinine attitude about this whole Ex-Im Bank issue. And on that note, Tim, I'm going to climb in off the ledge, and I will calm down.
We'll all take a breath. We want to thank all you folks for listening to us. Next week, by the way, we're going to be talking about the ISM report that will come out on this Friday, but we're going to be talking about it in depth. Typically, what you'll hear on Friday is the ISM PMI number is burnt, and you'll get a little sound bite, and that's all you'll hear. We go into that report in depth. Hopefully, Brad Holcomb, who's been with us on many, many shows, will have a chance to join us. If he doesn't, Lou and I will stumble our way through the ISM report and give you folks the insight from our perspective on what the ISM report is saying about what has happened over the last month in terms of manufacturing in the United States. And that wraps us up for Manufacturing Talk Radio today. Again, tune in next week or go to MFGTalkRadio.com to listen to any of our prior shows. They're all there under previous shows. We hope you will listen at your convenience. Thanks for listening today.
Thanks for joining us on Manufacturing Talk Radio. You can hear our next broadcast each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at MFGTalkRadio.com.